In pluralistic democracies, only radical nihilism and utterly rationalized beings could resolve this tension between the secularization, the flattening out, the voiding of meaning at the state level, and the overbuilding of meaning on the officially non-political, non-state level. And of course, radical nihilism and utterly rationalized beings adds up to something like a totalitarian vision that is exactly what liberalism arrays itself against. So that's the first point that comes out of this genealogy. The second one is this. Even as tolerance doctrine produces overburdened local truths and excessively thin public or universal ones, it also produces the inevitable relativism in the domain of moral and political truths that I earlier identified as an entailment of Reformation-inspired doctrines of tolerance. So this returns us to one of those paradoxes of tolerance that I already mentioned. The truth and the personhood that tolerance doctrine aims to protect is depicted in tolerance discourse as one of the deepest and most important features of human existence. Yet, that truth and personhood has to be lived and practiced in a contained, private, individualized, depoliticized fashion. For example, there's a recent world report on freedom of religion and belief. It comes out of a UN study. It's concerned with tolerance around the world and how many people in the world and how many different places have the right to express their conscience and their religious beliefs and desires freely. And it begins with this preamble. The capacity for belief is the defining feature of human personality. Religion or belief for anyone who professes either is one of the fundamental elements in his conception of life. End quote. Yet tolerance doctrine requires that these beliefs, so fundamental, so definitive of our humanness, must not be held or acted upon as moral absolutes or sites of moral superiority in the public domain. Tolerance requires a public accord with, a respect for, beliefs and values at odds with our own. Beliefs and values that we may consider terribly wrong, even immoral. Thus, in its peculiarly modern formulation, tolerance requires that what's considered the constitutive element of our humanness, belief, be cultivated and practiced privately, individually, without public effect, without public life. It also requires either that we be hypocritical in our respect for others, pretending to affirm what we actually consider wrong or heretical or dangerous, or that in public, at least, we be radical relativists, maintaining that our own beliefs have no more inherent value or credence than those of others. Now, if tolerance fosters both a radical withdrawal from public life that amounts to kind of social monadism, and it requires what I'm calling a certain epistemological and moral relativism, the effect of these requirements on political life is quite significant. Politics necessarily becomes amoral or anti-moral, to degrees never dreamed of by Machiavelli, and it becomes righteously relativist about truth. Symptoms of this condition appear in America in the incessant political talk in public life about the absence of and the need for deep moral values and religious convictions, but these things cannot be featured concretely in political discourse without violating the spirit of tolerance. Meanwhile, in keeping with what I'm calling the overbuilt sites of local truth that are produced by tolerance, moral absolutism seethes below the surface of politics, making public tolerance appear as little more than a kind of detente strategy for conflicts among private moral or religious absolutes. And tolerance also forces the displacement of religious belief and ethical conviction into what at best could be called rhetorically strategic political claims, giving political debate about value-laden policy a deeply disingenuous character and intensifying the rationalization of political life that Weber forecast according to other causes. Now, this story of politics stripped of ethical and religious conviction and of religion stripped of truth, value, and public purchase is, of course, the story of liberalism we've been telling ourselves for several centuries. The compromises that this story entails are variously celebrated and decried by theologians, constitutional scholars, political theorists, citizens, and political actors. However, there's a peculiar formation of identity and difference in recent decades that I think has added a new fillip to these already troubling tensions between community and truth, public life and belief, local enmity, and universal tolerance. And it's to that formation that I now want to turn. One contribution that Michel Foucault has made to understanding contemporary political life pertains to his tracing of the formation and regulation of the modern subject through a discursive equation of certain beliefs and practices with a putatively essential or inner truth of a given subject. Foucault understands this kind of subject formation, which, put briefly, would be one in which behaviors or beliefs are imagined to be traceable to an inner hidden truth in the human being. And those truths and those behaviors and belief in turn are regulated by the sciences of behavior and belief. He understands that kind of subject formation as a means of ordering and classifying and regulating individuals in the age of mass society. Foucault's best known example of this kind of subject formation is the construction of the homosexual in modernity through what he understands as the convergence of various scientific, administrative, and religious discourses. The story in brief, it's very familiar for those who already know the text, but I'll just recapitulate it. According to Foucault, what was regarded prior to the 18th century as a contingent act, a homosexual act, becomes through 19th century medicine, psychiatry, pedagogy, religion, and sexology, action that increasingly becomes treated as constitutive of identity, such that homosexual acts come to be seen as expressions of the subject who is called homosexual. Moreover, Foucault argues, these acts, once understood as simply acts rather than as identity, these acts come to be understood as indicative of the core truth of the homosexual subject, indeed as acts that exhaust the truth of that subject. So no longer is one defined as being of this village or that family, this language group or that vocation. Rather, today, we are defined according to a particular and fundamental sexual or other persona, an identity that's rooted in desire and behavior. Here's the oft-quoted passage from History of Sexuality in which Foucault summarizes this transition. As defined by ancient civil or canonical codes, sodomy was a category of forbidden acts. Their perpetrator was nothing more than the juridical subject of them. The 19th century homosexual became a personage, a past, a case history, and a childhood. In addition to being a type of life, a life form, a morphology, nothing that went into his total composition was seen as unaffected by his sexuality. It was everywhere present in him, at the root of all his actions, because it was their insidious and indefinitely active principle. Homosexuality appeared as one of the forms of sexuality when it was transposed from the practice of sodomy onto a kind of interior androgyny, a hermaphrodism of the soul. The sodomite had been a temporary aberration. The homosexual was now a species. Foucault makes a similar claim in Discipline and Punish. He says there that what once was regarded as a criminal act, a singular event, is now, in the 19th century, with the disciplines of discipline and other behavioral discourses, is now treated as the core and exhaustive truth of the person. It's the criminal mind, the criminal soul, the criminal being. The prisoner becomes a type, a case, a total personality, as she or he becomes the subject and object of criminology, psychology, sociology, and medicine. Now, if Foucault's right about this dimension of subject production in modernity, and if he's right about its fairly steady expansion as a form of biopower, the regulation of persons through the regulation of life, it adds another worrisome dimension to the tolerance problem, because certain practices and experiences, in which we may include beliefs, become cast as the necessary entailment of fundamental types of subjects. So, identities such as black, or Jew, or lesbian, or even Holocaust survivor, appear both as radically exhaustive of the person and as necessarily entailing a certain set of beliefs and practices. The practice or attribute is seen as issuing from the person, the ontology, and it's seen as constitutive of certain kinds of experiences, and this combination of soul and experiences in turn is treated as the fount of certain views or beliefs. Now, if tolerance designates the right to mutual existence possessed by these identities that represent nodes of belief, experience, and practices. It also designates them as existing in a potentially or even inherently hostile relationship to one another. Because they're built as sites of identitarian truth that differ fundamentally from the truth of others. So respective identities cancel out one another's truths, threatening or canceling one another's orthodoxies or absolutes. And that means in the case of identity, threatening or canceling out one another as persons. In other words, the enmity or cancellation that tolerance discourse, when it's applied to contemporary subjects as Foucault describes them, enmity or cancellation among individuals is not simply at the level of belief, this one's a Protestant, this one's a Catholic, or experience, this one spent her whole life in Italian education system, this one went off to the colonies as a child. Rather, the enmity or cancellation, the difference, is imagined at the level of persons, because the person and the belief are conflated and indexed through attribute or practice. So moral relativism, once pertaining to belief in tolerance doctrine, coined through an undecidable discord among beliefs, is now conveyed to identity based in body and soul. From this perspective, it would appear that the incorporation of a language of tolerance into the contemporary ethic of cultural pluralism is no mere accidental slide from a discourse that was once about free speech and religion to one that's now concerned with ethnicity, sexuality, or race. We used to be worked up about religious differences, now we're worked up about ethnic or sexual or racial differences. Rather, this incorporation of tolerance doctrine into a contemporary ethos of cultural pluralism appears to express a historical formation in which subjects today are identified with or reduced to certain attributes or practices, which in turn are held to be generative of certain beliefs and consciousness. So these beliefs and this consciousness are presumed to issue from the soul or inner truth of the person, and in this peculiarly modern discourse of subjects, opinions, belief, and practices are cast not as matters of conscience, not as matters of education, not as matters of revelation, but as the material of the person of which attributes, racial, sexual, or gendered, may be an index. Hence the notion, for example, of black consciousness or queer sensibility, in which one's race or sexuality is considered to generate the consciousness, the beliefs, the practices, the difference that has to be protected or tolerated. Now, this formulation of persons and of what tolerance is protecting stands in significant contrast to the notion that beliefs are personal, individually derived, or contingent, the expression of our fundamental humanness as our agentic individuality. In its place, I'm suggesting, this other order of subject formation expresses our humanness as cultural, ethnic, or sexual being, not as choosing, thinking, free individuals. There's an additional paradox here, one that Foucault also draws our attention to. In Discipline and Punish, Foucault argues that disciplinary power marks a moment in what he calls the reversal of the political axis of individualization. And what he means by this unfelicitous phrase is this. In contrast to feudal and other non-disciplinary societies, in which he says individualization is greatest where sovereignty is exercised. It's greatest in the higher echelons of power. The queen, the lord, all those people are individualized. The peasants are a mass. Foucault says, in contrast to such societies, in disciplinary regimes, individualization is descending. That is, as power becomes more anonymous and more functional, those upon whom power is exercised tend to become more strongly individualized. In disciplinary societies, then, the normal subject is less individualized than the one who deviates from the norm. Thus, in a system of discipline, the child is more individualized than the adult, the patient more than the healthy person, the madman and the delinquent more than the normal and the non-delinquent. In each case, it's toward the first of these pairs that all the individualizing mechanisms are turned in our civilization. And when one wishes to individualize the healthy, normal, and law-abiding adult, it's always by asking him how much of the child he has in him. What secret madness lies within him? What fundamental crime or perversion has he dreamt of? Foucault's point, and the point that I now want to draw toward this argument about tolerance, is this. This heightened individualization of the deviant, the abject, the other, gives us a further clue about the normalizing work of contemporary tolerance discourse, because individuals who are tolerated will always be those who deviate from the norm, never those who uphold it. They will also be further articulated. I've developed a cold since the last time I saw you, so I have a slightly different voice and a little less stamina. Please tell me to speak up if you can't hear me. So last time, what I tried to offer was a schema of some of my general worries about tolerance today as a discourse of multicultural justice. I tried to map a very brief etymological and genealogical account of what tolerance has been in the European context and what it's come to be, and especially tried to consider the shift in the objects and the venue of tolerance from the 16th century to the present. Today, my question, as Cornelia suggested, is this. Why is the condition of women or relations among the sexes so rarely framed in terms of a discourse of tolerance? Certainly there are occasions when gender inclusion engages this discourse, when, for example, women seek access to radically male homosocial venues, such as exclusive social clubs, military schools, sports teams, and so forth. But equality, not tolerance, is our conventional rubric for speaking about gender desegregation and gender equity. Why? Why is it that the place of minority religions, minority ethnicities and races, minority sexualities are all treated as subjects for tolerance, but the place of women is not? Could the key be in the word minority? That is, does tolerance always signify a majoritarian response to an outlying or minoritarian element in its midst? Is it simply the case that majorities can never be the subject for tolerance? I think proportionalist demographic analyses provide the least interesting answer to this riddle. So in what follows, I'm going to explore, rather speculatively, some other paths. And I want to begin with a different take on the question I've just posed. Why was the Jewish question, the question of including Jews and emancipating Jews in consolidating European states, so often framed as a matter of tolerance in the 18th and 19th centuries in Europe? While the woman question, from the beginning, emerged through a language of subordination and equality. Or, the contemporary version, in the United States, why was the 1988 Democratic vice presidential candidacy of Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman who was ever nominated to a candidacy for vice president or president, why was that heralded by journalists and others as a victory for feminist equity struggles? While the recent nomination in the last election in the United States of the Orthodox Jew, Joseph Lieberman, why was that nomination cast by political pundits as a triumph of tolerance? It's insufficient to respond that Jews were ostracized or ghettoized while women were subjected individually by individual men, because whatever the difference in the mode of disenfranchisement or discrimination or exclusion, both were rooted in a putatively important difference from the figure of universal man at the heart of the emerging European constitutional political orders. And both exclusions provoked a common desire and a common political goal, namely political enfranchisement, political rights, access to public institutions, including education and a range of vocations. In a word, indeed in the word that was most often used in the 19th century, both provoked demands for emancipation. But why did one emancipation movement remain within the rubric of tolerance and inclusion while the other was framed as a project of equality? How and why did emancipation efforts fork in this way? And what light does this historical phenomenon shed upon the relationship of equality to tolerance within liberalism? In liberal discourse, equality presumes sameness, while tolerant is the supplement that liberalism developed and employed to deal with difference, to deal with the problem of inclusion where sameness is not understood to prevail. So why did the sex difference become thinkable through the terms of sameness, while Jewishness did not? First, what I want to do is consider very briefly some of the discourses organizing Judaism and organizing gender as emancipation questions took shape in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I'll do this in an extremely crude and broad brushstroke kind of way. And against the backdrop of those discourses, I will then try to examine more closely the trajectory of these two questions. The Jews. To think through the formation of the Jewish question, the relationship of this formation to the construction and position of Jews in the 19th century, and the relationship of this to the establishment of Jews as subjects of tolerance, I'm going to focus initially and primarily upon post-revolutionary France. This, of course, seems perverse, or at least paradoxical at first blush, given that between 1791 and the Dreyfus Affair at the turn of the 20th century, France understood itself to have utterly preempted the Jewish question, the question that was raging elsewhere on the continent, with straightforward emancipation and enfranchisement of Jews. But as we shall see, the picture's a bit more complex. Moreover, it's precisely because emancipation became the standard for the civic and political inclusion of Jews across Europe in the 19th century that France stands as a kind of paradigm or perhaps parable of modernity in the story that it harbors of Jewish emancipation, assimilation, and tolerance. The emancipation of Jews was intensely debated by the French National Assembly in December of 1789. The debate turned on the question of whether Jews were French, and if not, whether they could still become citizens in a newly born regime in which the Republic and its members were held to be mutually constitutive. For those such as Abbé Mouret, who insisted that the very term Jew denotes a nation, I'm quoting him, it followed that Jews should be protected, not enfranchised. They could not simultaneously belong to two nations, the Jewish one and the French one. But for those who understood the revolution itself as containing the project of French nation building, the clear task was to dismantle rather than honor remnants of Jewish nationhood. And here's the case put by Count Stanislaw de Clermont-Tonnerre, the lead speaker on behalf of Jewish emancipation in the December 1789 assembly session. And these phrases have often been quoted because they're signal for all kinds of other projects, but I'll read them to you anyway. Here's what he had to say. As a nation, and it's important to remember he's speaking on behalf of Jewish emancipation. As a nation, the Jews must be denied everything. As individuals, they must be granted everything. Their judges can no longer be recognized. Their recourse must be to our own judgment exclusively. Legal protection for the doubtful laws by which Jewish corporate existence is maintained must end. They cannot be allowed to create a political body or a separate order within the state. It is necessary that they be citizens individually. Entwining Hobbes and Foucault in a single sentence, Clermont-Tonnerre specifies the conditions and mechanisms entailed in fashioning the new citizen subject out of an old corporate body. Jews were to be individuated. They were to adhere to general rules, to a single legal and social norm, and to undivided state authority. What he makes clear is the tacit tolerance deal undergirding emancipation, even as French assembly members on all sides of the spectrum after the revolution rejected the notion of tolerance insofar as it carried the significance of a hegemonic religion that would then tolerate minority religions. And they rejected that language because they wanted to reject the idea that there was, in fact, a religious state and there was general anti-religious sentiment at the time. But what Clermont-Tonnerre makes clear is that there is a tolerance deal that undergirds emancipation. It's one that submits the tolerated subject to state administration at the very moment of emancipation and enfranchisement. Clermont-Tonnerre precisely expresses the twin processes of individuation and privatization of religious affiliations and beliefs that are entailed in belonging to the new universal state. They are processes that required, in a phrase, the Protestantization or Catholicization of the Jew. That is, to be compatible with membership in the French Republic, Jews had to be individuated, denationalized. Jewishness could no longer consist fundamentally of belonging to a community bound together by religious law, ritualized practices, or generational continuity. Rather, Jewishness would at most consist in privately held and conducted belief. Now, in December 1789, the French Assembly stalemated on the Jewish question. But 2 years later, when the issue of Jews inhabiting the eastern provinces was debated, the Assembly voted to rescind all decrees, prohibitions, and privileges relating to the Jews. Without resolving the question of whether Jews were French, of whether they constituted a nation apart, Jews were formally emancipated and enfranchised by the Assembly. Retrospectively, this move appears as inevitable, both as the logical extension of the French revolutionary principles of universal equality and liberty, and as consistent with the tendency of all European states at the end of the 18th century to centralize, rationalize, and regularize their power and reach. That is, the anomalous status of Jews in Europe during the medieval and early modern periods, their status as in but not of various European nations, had to be resolved. Jews had to be brought within the ambit and orbit of the state. They had to be incorporated into nations increasingly defined through abstract and universal citizenship and nations bound to states. But to be brought into the nation state, Jews also had to be made to fit, and for that they needed to be transformed, cleaned up, normalized. It's these double forces of recognition and remaking, of emancipation and subjection, of decorporatization as Jews and incorporation as nation-state citizens that characterize the relation of Jews to the state in 19th century Europe, and that comprise the tacit regime of tolerance, even if it was sometimes named emancipation, under which Jewish incorporation into the nation was managed. Back to France. What did it mean for French Jews to become citizens? Citizenship, of course, is widely known. In Republican France, was no formal category extended to individuals with rights. Rather, it involved membership in the Republic, identification with the state, and participation in French national culture. So while the process of making Jews citizens may have begun with emancipation, it concluded with making Jews French, which meant modulating both any distinctively Jewish sense of community and any distinctively Jewish practices and habits. But as assimilation proceeded over the course of the 19th century, not only in France, but obviously elsewhere, what kept Jews themselves from disappearing? That is, what kept assimilated Jews from disappearing altogether as Jews? How could Jewish practice, belief, or attachment to the Jewish nation radically decline or vanish altogether without taking the Jew with it? The mid-19th century formulation, unevenly developed but spread across Europe, of Jews as a physiological race replaced the 18th century understanding of Jews as defined by common language, beliefs, practices, or nationhood. According to 19th century race discourse, race was inscribed in every element of the body and soul, mind and sexuality, temperament and ability. Thus, race could endure after all the constituent elements of nation, elements which were not discursively inscribed attributes but had to be performed, after all of those elements had been radically reduced or eliminated. Race allowed, or required, depending on one's perspective, the Jew to be a Jew no matter how fully assimilated. Racialization would also produce a new subject of tolerance in Christian culture, the very one that we were discovering in the genealogy I mapped last time. That is, defined neither by belief nor by filiation, the racialized Jew would become highly individuated, as well as physiologically, intellectually, emotionally, and sexually saturated by Jewishness. This new Jewish subject would in turn bring into being, first of all, a new semiotics of tolerance, in which otherness was carried on and in the body, and secondly, a new administrative subject of tolerance, in which bodily being, rather than practices, beliefs, or filiation, would become decisive. one in which bodily being was presumed to carry the morphological code for all else, such that difference begins to become ontological and permanent, rather than understood as produced culturally or as a problem of group affinity. Thirdly, this new Jewish subject, or the racialization discourse that produced this new Jewish subject in the 19th century, would also produce a new and ambiguous source for conferring tolerance, one increasingly located in civil society, and not only the state, the church, or other sovereign institutions. The racialization of the Jew during the 19th century was produced by discourses that ranged from anthropological and biological to philological and literary. All of these discourses built on the 19th century zeal, scholarly and popular, for typology, classification, and measurement, and drew for evidence upon everything from brain size and survival capacity to the origins of languages and language group. The developing body of racial theory, as anyone knows who has studied it, was of course not internally coherent, it was not systematic, nor was it radically isolated from cultural theory and history. That is to say, there was a lot of cultural explanation mixed in with biological and physiological explanation. But what these unsystematic and unscientific theories provided to Jews, Gentiles, leftists, liberals, and anti-Semites alike was a means of establishing the enduring fact of Jewishness independently of religious belief or practice, particularly in the context of French Catholicism, but also in the more general context of European tolerance discourse concerned with Protestantism. The racialization of the Jew rendered Jewishness an exception to the general construal of religion as a belief community. Neither God nor Torah nor Jewish corporate community, nor ritual practices, were relevant to the identification of Jewishness once race had taken hold. Defined racially, Jewishness was something one carried individually everywhere and always. Again, this meant that tolerance would change the definition and circumscription of its objects. Jews might still be thought of as a group, but the structure of affinity rendering them a group was a race rather than a nation, putatively objective traits rather than subjective attachments or matters of consciousness. At the same time, racialization established the Jewish difference as deep and permanent, constituting Jews as eternal outsiders to a nation conceived in homogeneous terms. Most historians argue that despite the anti-Semitic uses to which it could be and was put, 19th century European Jews generally took up the discourse of racialization with equanimity and even zeal. However, awkwardly, the discourse of racialization allowed Jews to retain and comprehend a Jewish identity, one that established a modicum of community and connection across generations, even as Jews assimilated. It guaranteed, in short, that Jewishness would not itself perish through assimilation. Indeed, it seems to me a brace for the ambivalence inevitably entailed in assimilating. Assimilation in the context of racialization, of course, came with various kinds of subtle tolls, which themselves reveal important features of the politics of tolerance. As French Jews devoted themselves to becoming French, to identifying with Frenchness, not only was their connection to and identification with Jews in other lands necessarily attenuated, a matter of some significance in relation to the brutal Russian pogroms of the late 19th century, but Jews also had to moderate their own response to domestic anti-Semitism if they were not to seem excessively Jewish rather than French. In addition, to make the move from the margins to the mainstream of French society, most French Jews became quite politically and socially